Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We celebrate the start of the 2016 baseball season. Cardinal fans are excited, just as baseball fans here have been for about 150 years. As we look forward to memorable moments ahead for those Redbirds, we're going to look back on today's program. A brand new book is out titled Immortal Moments in Cardinals History, and there have been a lot of them. The book has been put together by baseball historian and author Bob Thiemann and longtime sports broadcaster Ron Jacober, both of whom joined me in studio. Gentlemen, nice to have you with us.
Good to see you, Don. Been a while.
Yes, it has been a while. Congratulations on the book. What a very, very handsome and photo-filled book it is. Nice job, both of you.
Yeah, it was 2 years in the making by Reedy Press, and Don did the yeoman job here. He's a great historian, a baseball historian, and I tell people, it weighs 4 pounds now, I tell people, read it with both hands or you're going to pull a muscle. It's that heavy.
Well, I can attest to that. I haven't pulled any muscles, but there's a good reason for that, too. There aren't many there to pull. Bob, let me start with you, and Ron will give the same question to you. I think St. Louis is generally considered around the country to be one of the best, if not the best, baseball town in the country. Why is that?
Well, a part of it is the success they've had over the decades, and especially now in the last, since the Bill DeWitt group took over, they're off the charts, really, as far as success. And the fact that everybody grows up in other towns, you could be a football fan before you're a baseball fan, but here, not really at all. I guess there are hockey fans that are more devoted to the Blues than they are to the Cardinals, but the vast majority in a very wide area have been there all their lives.
Ron, your thoughts on that. What makes this such a great baseball town?
I think it's tradition, and I think kids grow up as Cardinal fans, and when they're adults, they're Cardinal fans too. The attendance records are phenomenal. Yeah. This team drew more fans than any team in baseball except Los Angeles last season. Now, we're like the 20th largest market, I think the fifth smallest market in Major League Baseball. But they've had some good success over the years, and Cardinal players are revered by the fans here. I mean, they become almost part of the family. When you look at opening day and like the other day with Lou Brock throwing out the first pitch and Bob Gibson and Ozzie Smith and those guys, people relate to them, and they become almost part of the culture, and I think that's part of it. And frankly, it's kind of resented in some cities around the country. You know, they say the Cardinal way. That's a lot of baloney. But I think that when they get here, the players realize how special it is. And a lot of players who come here not knowing, when they get here, they understand it and realize there is a Cardinal way and this is a special town for baseball.
And a lot of them stay.
Oh, they stay after
their careers.
No question, yeah. They do. A lot of them still live in this area. Sure they do.
Yeah, you know, winning doesn't hurt. That's
not at all. Yeah. Like Ron said, now we're becoming sort of like the Yankees of the American League. Or what the Yankees are in the American League, we're becoming in the National League.
We're the
perennial
enemy.
The enemy. Right?
Well, you know, I'll just weigh in on this, if I may, because I grew up in New Jersey and listened to Mel Allen and Red Barber do the games, spent some time in Baltimore. Chuck Thompson was the announcer. I think the announcers, the radio announcers here in town, have an awful lot to do with the way fans react to the team.
Well, this has been a great city for sportscasters. There's no question about it. Over the years, we look at, Casas and Bucks, and, both Bucks, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And Mike, has been behind the mic for all these 40-plus years, and Bob Starr in the other days, Harry Carey. I knew Harry pretty well. I found Harry, covered Harry the day he was fired by the Brewery. I was the only one that found him, by the way, which is another story for another day. But
well, I don't know. I've heard you tell this story, and I know Schlitz Beer played a prominent role
rather than
Budweiser.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of it. Yeah, I think that's part of it. Now, there have been a lot of legendary announcers around the country. Vince Scully in Los Angeles is maybe the best ever I've ever heard in terms of his ability to articulate and describe a play. Theater of the mind is what radio is, and he is so good at it. But this town's been blessed with a lot of great sportscasters, no doubt.
Well, the book starts obviously before there was radio broadcasters or sportscasters to be had. Bob, let me ask you to just take us back a little bit to the earliest days. I remember we had an author in here not too long ago who wrote a book about Chris Von Ea. Is that the way the name is?
Vondere.
Vondere, yes, Vondere. I'm sorry. Vondere. and credited him with having saved professional baseball.
Well, he was the founder of this franchise in 1882, and the it was part of a new league called the American Association, the Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and St. Louis, all of which had had teams in the National League, which had been founded just a few years before, but had been, for one reason or other, booted out by the sanctimonious owner, the league president from Chicago. And these clubs got together, including Vandrei in St. Louis with his club, and they sold their tickets for the popular price at those days. 25 cents is what would get you into an American Association game, whereas you had to pony up 50 cents to get in the National League. And
still better than today.
A little bit better than today, yes. And so they, all the American Association clubs in the new league, they did very well, although they weren't as good on the field as the National League generally. And eventually, after 10 years in existence, half of the American Association clubs were merged into the National League. We made it National League a 12-team league. And at that point, 8 of the 12 teams had started out in the American Association. So it really was the model that proved more popular and longer.
Wasn't there something also associated with Sunday baseball and, by the way, selling a little beer along the way?
Oh, yes. Both of those were against the rules in the National League, and which is one reason why the St. Louis franchise that was the founder of the National League failed. But the part of the deal then to allow the American Association clubs into the merged league was to allow Sunday games. So St. Louis had the first Sunday National League game here in 1892. They also were allowed to keep their beer sales, which else spread to almost all the other clubs pretty quickly. Although, interestingly, for Sunday games, the old teams, National League teams, were allowed to opt out. They say even on the road, they when Boston and Philadelphia and Brooklyn and Pittsburgh and none of those would play Sunday games initially. And actually, Boston and Philadelphia held out for 10 years, wouldn't even play on the road.
Right.
There used to be a curfew, didn't they, on Sunday in a lot of the cities?
Well, that was much later. That was when they finally allowed Sunday games into Pennsylvania, they had a 6 p.m. curfew for Sunday games. So there was all sorts of shenanigans going on. If we got the lead, can we delay till 6 o'clock so we don't have to play any more innings?
You know, a lot of the younger readers may not realize that the Browns became the Cardinals, and people are surprised about that when they don't know too much of the history.
It gets kind of confusing because we have Browns, confusing. Cardinals, yeah. Browns, right. Browns, Cardinals.
And then the Perfectos one year, they were called the Perfectos.
You know, Ron, any kind of involvement in history often gives the opportunity to learn something. What did you learn that you didn't know about the early days of the Cardinals franchise?
Well, I think a lot of what he's talking about, what Bob's talking about, and how the game was played, how it was run. I mean, there were times when fans were allowed on the field, for example, and I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And a ball hit into the fans was a ground rule double because they had no room in the stands. There were so many people.
They stand in the outfield.
Stand in the outfield. Yeah. And in fact, there's a picture in the book that Bob has about that where the crowd is in the field. And, I mean, they drew some large crowds. The grandstands weren't that big. Bleachers weren't that big. And they became very popular, so people were standing in the field.
You know, it's fun, Bob, to look at the photographs and see the kind of equipment, in particular the gloves. And, of course, in the early days, they didn't use gloves at all.
A lot of them didn't. By 1882, first basemen and pitchers and catchers were pretty all wearing gloves. Although, when they said they wore gloves, they would wear two. Well, the pitchers would only wear one. But one on each hand because the gloves were just like driving gloves, and there was no web to catch the ball in, so you had to use two hands to catch it.
Now they look like bushel baskets, you know.
Absolutely.
The outfielder's gloves anyway.
Can you imagine, though, being a catcher and not having anything resembling the kind of equipment they have today?
Well, it was tough. The catcher would stay back and try to catch the ball on the first bounce unless, you know, if there was nobody on base or if it was two strikes. You still had to catch the third strike, although you could catch it on the first bounce. So they were not quite as close as they were, but there were lots of gruesome injuries to catchers before the masks.
What do you think it was that caused the game to become as popular as it did? I mean, it was kind of crude during the earliest days, obviously.
Everybody could play it.
Yeah.
Even girls could play it, yeah. Whether it be softball or baseball. And I think that's different from football, certainly different from hockey. Mm-hmm. And you grow up as a kid and you put a bat in your hands and you can swing it and hit a ball. And I think that's one of the reasons why baseball became so popular, you know, 100 years ago or 80 years ago or 70 years ago, because everybody could play it. Maybe not very well, but everybody could play it.
What about the players back in the day? We'll come up in more modern times in a couple of minutes. But what about back in the early days? What were they like?
Well, they were oftentimes very hard drinking. A lot of them were from poorer backgrounds, as has always been the case, and some of them were not touched by social
graces
very well. The Browns had their star center fielder, a guy named Kurt Welch, died before he was 40 years old. Last report before his funeral or before the report of his death was he's living in East Liverpool, Ohio, a wreck from drink.
You know, there when the Gas House Gang was around, you know, the reports about the Gas House Gang where they were a filthy, dirty, smelly group of I forget what the exact term was, but people anyway. They were not highly respected because, you know, they were just guys and they just came out to play.
You know, the first story I ever did in the news business was to track down some old Yankees when I grew up in New Jersey and do stories on where are they now.
Oh, yeah.
And I found six of them, and every one of them was a bartender.
Is that right?
Yeah, every one
are
of them was a bartender.
Me?
No,
that's
not
funny.
At all. Yeah.
Well, alcohol was played a big part
sure.
in the game.
And, of course, they had to do something else during the offseason.
Well, even up to probably 20, 25 years ago, the players had to do something in the offseason to make a living. Now, of course, the salaries are so huge that they don't. But you know what they do? Most of the good players stay in shape 12 months of the year.
Well, yeah. Well, if you're making $20 million a year,
better.
Why not? Why
yeah,
not?
Better, yeah.
Have to take a break. We'll do that now. My guest in studio, Ron Jacober. You know him from his many years on radio and television here in St. Louis. And Bob Thiemann. They are co-authors of Immortal Moments in Cardinals History, a wonderful coffee table book, which is exactly what the title would tell you. Immortal Moments in Cardinals History. Back to continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call to 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, we'll take that at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Ron Jacober and Bob Thiemann. Let me point out, by the way, that these two gentlemen will be at the downtown St. Louis Public Library this Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m., and they'll be lecturing and signing
book. Books. And I think they have some Cardinal tickets to give away, too, by the way.
Oh, well,
Public
that,
Library.
So. That'll get some people down there.
I would hope so, yeah.
No conflict with the ball game? It's
no.
A night game?
Yeah.
One of the things that I picked up out of your book, and there are so many tidbits and facts in it, Bob, I'll go to you on this, was Cy Young, I think, over 2 years, pitched 670 innings, something like that.
It wasn't his most two productive years in that sense either.
Well, the question is obvious. You know, today nobody's doing anything like that. What was the difference between the arm of a Cy Young and some of the guys pitching today?
Well, Cy Young was a physical specimen. He was exceptional. He also he had perfect control. He had a very good fastball, but he had great control with it, which is very rare. And so he could put the ball right where he wanted it for the pitch batters, and they would have to swing at it, so he wouldn't have to do as many pitches as most pitchers in those days or today. And also the ball, they would try to keep a ball in as long as possible. If it was fouled in the stands, the fans were supposed to throw it back. And until it got too beat up or too dirty, they'd try to keep it in. Now, usually there was very seldom where you go one ball for a whole game, but that was the theory at least. So the ball was harder to hit, especially later in the game. And so Cy Young was one of those guys, Bob Gibson much later, where you had to get him early or you weren't going to win the game.
You know, he mentioned Gibson's 1968 when he set the record of 1.12 earned run average. He pitched 28 complete games and 13 shutouts in that one season.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's mind-boggling when you think about it in the context of today's pitchers, where if a starter goes six innings, oh, boy, he had a great game.
And it's given a quality start
whatever they call it.
And
yeah.
No more than 100 pitches.
Yeah, but he still lost nine games that year, which was crazy. But he was always paired against the opponent's best pitcher. You know,
we asked a lot of our listeners to weigh in on what they thought were the most memorable moments. Needless to say, the reference point only goes back about 20, 25 years or
sure.
so because of the ages. But Gibson pitching on a broken leg is one of them. Did you want to tell us about that?
Well, that's not a moment we've got in the book, but I was at that game, and he got hit on the heel by a line drive, and he went down in an obvious pain, and you thought, oh, this is terrible. And then he got back up, and, well, I'm going to keep pitching. And so he pitched to another batter, and then the second batter, that fracture in his leg snapped, and then he was definitely out. So if he had gone out after that first injury, he probably would have missed maybe 4 or 5 weeks. Instead, he missed 10 weeks.
Yeah, Nelson Briles took his place and was phenomenal.
Won nine in a row.
Gibson was back for the World Series that year. I mean, the guy's the toughest guy I've ever known in sports.
Were the pitchers back in the day of that generation and farther back, were they tougher than the players today?
I don't know if they're tougher, but they're trained differently. Hmm. You know, today the concept is, starter goes six innings, then we go to the bullpen. So they're not trained to go nine innings. They're not trained to throw that many pitches. I don't know if they're tougher. They were tougher. I don't know. I guess it's all relative, but they may be. They may have been, but because the concept of pitching has totally changed.
Yeah. Bob, in looking back, and there's so much to talk about, obviously, with all the long history of this, in putting all of this together, is there a moment, an incident, a play, a something out of all of the data that you compiled here that stands out as the moment, historic moment for the team? Unfair question probably, but what the heck?
Well, the moment was winning the 1926 World Series. That's what made the Cardinals, you know, their first World Series since the days of the St. Louis Browns and the American Association. And that's really what set the Cardinals on the path to becoming, you know, the Yankees of the National League. And Grover Cleveland Alexander was the guy who was the star of the World Series. And he was, you know, much more famous as a Philly and even as a Cub pitcher. But
Ron, you attended that series, didn't you?
Yeah, I covered it. I think the other thing that happened was Branch Rickey, when he was with the Cardinals, farming. He was the father of the farm system. And at one time, Bob tells me, the Cardinals had over 20 minor league teams. He would develop the players. And, of course, one of those players is prominent in that book, and that's Mr. Musial, who started out as a left-handed pitcher.
He really is prominent. I mean, you can't go many pages without running into pictures of Stan Musial, and with great justification.
Well, he's the greatest Cardinal of all, of course.
Yeah.
But you know, young people don't realize he was a pitcher, but he could hit. And there's I found a famous piece of video when we inducted Stan in the Hall of Fame of Branch Rickey, mm-hmm. who had gone to a minor league spring training camp. And he was talking to the manager. The manager said, well, we got this young guy, Musial. He said, you mean that left-handed pitcher, Musial, that I sent down here for practice? And then he told the story. The manager said, well, you should see where he hit a ball. So they took Rickey out and passed the left field fence across the railroad tracks. And on the other side, this is where Musial hit it. And Rickey said to the manager, if you didn't see it, you wouldn't believe it, right? Yeah. The manager said, no. Rickey said, I don't believe it either. But he turned out to be a great hitter and came through that system at lightning speed.
unless you're really something of a historian, most people don't forget that Branch Rickey was here for all those years.
Oh, yeah.
Because of what subsequently happened with
Jackie Robinson, yeah.
Right, exactly.
By the way, that show on Robinson that's on Channel 9 yesterday and today, or was it?
It's this week.
Monday and Tuesday. Yeah. I saw the first part. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Phenomenal piece of video.
Right. We'll have to take a look at that.
It should be shown in schools for kids that don't understand what people of that race went through when Jackie Robinson came into Major League Baseball.
Right, and I think back some darker moments in Cardinal history. Enos Slaughter, I think took a lot of heat for some of his attitude.
And well, he should have.
Yeah, as well. Yes, yes.
Although the one famous Slaughter spiking Robinson at first base, it wasn't a debilitating injury or anything. Robinson actually was the last out of the game trying to steal later, six innings later or whatever. So.
And, of course, a lot of that is offset by Slaughter's famous dash for home back in 46, I guess it was.
Yeah, and that's in the book.
I know it's in the book. Let's get a couple of calls in here. We'll bring us up to the more modern day, I think, by talking to Martin. He's calling from Potosi. Go ahead, Martin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Miss you, Ron. I really enjoyed seeing you on TV.
I miss it, too, but there comes a time.
I know. Everything changes, not always for the better, but here we are anyway. I just want to tell you that I happen to be lucky enough to be 12 years old and see the seventh game of the 1964 World Series, which was one of the best moments, I think, in Cardinal history. Now, Bob Gibson, of course, Lou Brock, all and on and on against the Yankees. And I actually was in right field. I tried to talk to Mr. Mantle, but he was not really – I guess he had his game, face on, and he wasn't interested in, talking to a Cardinal fan. But it was one of the best moments. I mean, when they won that at the original Busch Stadium, it was like, if you can go make a few comments on it, I'll take it up here. Thank you.
Well, we've got that in the book. All the World Championship clinchers are in the book, Memorial Moments. So.
Yeah, that was a great team too. Yeah. Great Cardinal team, and beating the Yankees was always special.
Yeah. A number of people have weighed in on what they thought the best moments were. Caitlin writes in Game 6. That's freeze, right?
That's the freeze game. Yeah, that's
right.
Freeze game.
And
it's in there, by the way. And what I encourage people to read that story because Lance Berkman drove in the tying run. The Cardinals came from behind five times in that game, and Berkman drove in the tying run in the 10th inning, giving Freeze the opportunity to hit the home run in the 11th inning. So there was so much went in there. It was more than David Freeze, although everybody talks about the Freeze game.
Where does the go crazy, folks, go crazy line from Jack Buck stack up, and how does it stack up in all of this history?
Oh, it's pretty prominent. We've got that game in the book, and the next game when Jack Clark hit the home run.
Yeah. When Ozzie's home run, he had never hit a left-handed home run in over 3,000 at-bats when he hit that off of Tom Nieuwenhuyer. And I asked Jack about that call one time, go crazy, folks, go crazy. Mm-hmm. He said, when I said it, I realized, I shouldn't have said that. That was pretty stupid. Turned out to be one of the great calls of his career.
Absolutely. And a number of people have cited that as the most memorable moment.
Just before he said go crazy, only the great sportscaster has the right verbs. He said Smith corks one to right, which is exactly what he did. And it might go.
Yeah.
Go crazy, folks.
Yeah. And it hit the concrete pillar out there, which kind of confused some people, thinking it was hit the wall, but that was over the wall and one of the great moments in Cardinal history. But I was humored by Jack's description of that because he said, I thought that was really a stupid call. But, the best calls, having done many games, the best calls are the ones that are unrehearsed and just spontaneous.
Sure.
And that was certainly one of them.
And not many can beat him when it comes to
that. Well, I don't know who can. You're right about that.
Let's take another call. Steve joins us from Creve Coeur. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, I was just wondering, I never saw Stan Musial play. He was a little before I was around. I was wondering how he compares to Albert Pujols, who in my generation was just the most amazing player that I can ever remember as a Cardinal.
That's an interesting question, and it would be tough to – they're different players.
They were both in their time with the Cardinals, or for 10 years, Muzio for more, the best player in the National League. The Albert didn't have the speed of Muzio when Stan was young,
right?
But more home run power. But I would say, and they both won 3 MVP awards. So you know, it's hard to say which one was better. They were very comparable, except, of course, Stan had the longevity here that right. Albert doesn't.
Well, over 20 years, and Albert's here 10, I guess, or 11.
Yeah.
And he should still be here, by the way. And I think he regrets the decision that he made, but let's leave it at that.
Yeah, well, we could do a whole program or two on just on that very subject. Gentlemen, we're going to have to let it go at that. I'm afraid time has gone by so quickly. Again, we'll recommend this book very, very highly. You'll love it if you're a Cardinal fan, even if you're not. The Immortal Moments in Cardinal History. Ron Jacober and Bob Thiemann, thank you for being with us. A reminder that they'll be participating in a lecture and book signing of the book, Immortal Moments in Cardinals History, Saturday from 2 to 4 p.m. at the St. Louis Public Library downtown. So if you want to see the book and see these guys, that's the place to do it. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Ron.
Good to see you, Don.
Good to see you, too. Thank you. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.